Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. The New Hampshire Supreme Court says eliminating the distinction between residency and domicile for voting purposes is constitutional. Lawmakers returned to Concord to fight a Supreme Court decision that could force certain New Hampshire businesses to collect sales tax on behalf of other states. And Democratic gubernatorial candidate Steve Marchand gets specific on how he would attempt to protect abortion rights in the state. These and other stories made headlines this week, and we'll talk about them this hour. You can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. That's all one word. And we're also streaming a live video of this radio show, so check it out at our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And here to talk about the week's news and answer your questions are Dave Solomon, reporter for the Union Leader, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and joining us for this part of the show, NHPR's Lauren Chulgin. Welcome, everybody.
Good morning.
Hey, morning.
Again, the phone number for you to call to join the conversation, 1-800-892-6477. And let's talk about the New Hampshire Supreme Court first this morning. Justices said eliminating the distinction between domicile and residency for voting purposes is constitutional. They've been asked by Governor Chris Sununu to review the constitutionality of the bill before he decides whether or not to sign it. Two justices declined to answer, but three did answer. And what did they say, Dave?
Well, in an advisory opinion, they said that based on their review of the legislation, the bill that was put in front of them, they don't see it any constitutional problems with blending the definition of domicile and residency as the bill proposed, and in effect creating a residency requirement for voting. It's important to keep in mind that this was an advisory opinion. It's not a court ruling. It doesn't set any kind of precedent. And it's very likely, in fact, inevitable, that if the bill is signed into law, that somewhere down the line there will be a court challenge, and there's no guarantee that the outcome of that particularly litigated case will be consistent with the court's advisory opinion. But at this point, Governor Sununu has a clear glide path to sign the bill, despite the political corner he painted himself in by saying on video several months ago to a student activist that he would never sign any bill that would suppress the student vote. And by many accounts, this bill could have that effect.
And let's hear what Governor Sununu had to say about this on June 20th on the Howie Carr Show, signaling support for this bill, which is HB 1264, if it did get approval from the state Supreme Court. The phone line in this tape is a little bit shaky because he was in a car on a cell phone.
So what I did is I've taken that bill, I sent it to the Supreme Court. I said, give us your opinion on it so that assuming they come back in the affirmative and they assure that it's constitutional, we can sign the bill with, I think, great confidence that we're protecting the integrity of the system. We haven't violated any constitutional rights. And finally, New Hampshire's laws are kind of up to par with everybody else. We're the anomaly. People have to understand you need to be a resident of Massachusetts or Vermont or Maine. You don't need to be a resident here.
And Governor Sununu saying that New Hampshire is sort of an outlier when it comes to breaking it up, giving college students who aren't actually residents the ability to vote here. Is he correct, Dave?
This comes up repeatedly, and it's been said repeatedly on this program that technically what the governor says is true. These residency requirements exist in Maine and Massachusetts, but there's no cross-enforcement with the motor vehicle law. So declaring residency in those states to vote does not compel you to obtain a license in those states to drive or register your car in those states. So if New Hampshire proceeds to enact a law like this, The big question will then become, will there be cross-enforcement with motor vehicle laws, or will there be a law passed exempting that enforcement as exists in Vermont, Maine, and Massachusetts?
Ethan?
I was just going to add what he just said at the end about Vermont having a specific provision that does exempt college students from having to go through these motor vehicle registration fees and license fees, and that's something that opponents of this bill have pointed to as New Hampshire not having if this bill were to pass.
Mm-hmm. And among the opponents of this bill include Gilles Bissonnette of the New Hampshire ACLU, who says that the fight over this bill is far from over.
This decision doesn't prevent this bill, if it's signed into law, and we think it should be vetoed, from being successfully challenged in court with the benefit of a full record developed in litigation.
So Gilles Bissonnette clearly unhappy about the court's decision, but reminding us that we're not necessarily bound. He's not, the governor's not necessarily bound to sign this. No. Will there be political consequences if he does?
Well, there'll certainly be political consequences if he doesn't, which is why I think it's extremely likely that he will. And the political consequences will be what is pretty clear in front of him is continued opposition from Democrats and young voters and minority voters who are largely affected by these kinds of voting laws. The other consequence of this decision, not having a lot to do with voting directly, is the reaction in the legal community to this split decision on the Supreme Court of New Hampshire and the fact that the 3-2 vote in sort of signing off on the law fell along party lines in terms of the appointments of the justices. And this has raised a lot of eyebrows in a state where the Supreme Court has a tradition of unanimity on big cases. And to see a case like this come down in a 3-2 vote with the three justices who were either appointed or promoted by Sununu voting in the majority and the two justices appointed by John Lynch, essentially saying, look, we passed on requests like this just 3 years ago in 2015 when an election law was in front of us and we said we're not going to give advisory opinions on this kind of thing unless we have a litigated case in front of us. And those two justices appointed by Lynch basically said, so why are we doing it now? And it has raised the prospect of political divisions on the Supreme Court of New Hampshire, similar to what we're seeing playing out at the national level, and that's disturbing in many quarters.
I think the timeline is worth bearing in mind. The road is long ahead for this. They changed the effective date to 2019, so we won't see the effects of this if it's signed in the upcoming elections. That basically sets this up for the presidential elections, for the primaries and the presidential election, and that's where I think we're going to see a lot of attention centered around how this is messaged if it's signed, what different groups on the left and the right use this law to do, and ultimately how it's challenged, because I think that it would, as Dave noted, it's certainly going to be challenged in some form. Whether it's challenged before the election, the presidential election, or after the presidential election remains to be seen. But senators, it should be noted, at the time when they extended this deadline, they did so with an eye to legislation. They actually explicitly said, to litigation. They explicitly said that, there's a risk of this, so we don't want to rush the implementation of this law. So there'll be a long germination period where kind of a lot could develop with how this law is interpreted.
We get an email from Nancy, who wrote in to say, I suggest that if Governor Sununu is going to sign what she's calling the anti-voting bill, he needs to open many more DMV offices in the state. If you're in Hanover and have no car, most don't, you can't get to Newport, which is the closest DMV. So that speaks to what you were saying, Dave, that the DMV is not involved in this, and sometimes it seems like it might should be.
Well, the whole question of how these requirements would be enforced remains unanswered and is just another one of the many points that will have to be addressed moving forward in addition to the future litigation, which I believe won't come about until someone goes and tries to vote, finds themselves unable to for reasons largely related to this law, and then would become a defendant with standing to bring a case to the court.
We have another court to talk about, and that is the Supreme Court. Supreme Court made a decision known as the Wayfair decision, which lawmakers here in Concord reconvened to sort of figure out a way to push back against. This is the decision that would open the door to force certain businesses in New Hampshire and four other states without a sales tax to collect sales tax on behalf of those other states. House Speaker Gene Chandler welcomed lawmakers to the special session this week.
We're all gathered together in what I believe is going to be a bipartisan and hopefully, I'd like to see unanimous, but whoever knows about that, but fix to this situation to protect New Hampshire's businesses from this onerous decision.
And Governor Sununu also commented on the precedent set by the internet sales tax.
The rest of the country is watching us, and this isn't just about 40 other states. This is about 10,000 other taxing jurisdictions that would have the opportunity to come in here and demand that our businesses become their tax collectors. That is not the New Hampshire way. It's absolutely not right, and we're going to fight it with every means that we have.
So Governor Sununu clearly ready to put up a fight over this. What could lawmakers do? Ethan, Dave, what do you think?
Well, the lawmakers will pass a bill, I believe, and Governor Sununu will sign one that is going to create a very difficult obstacle course, if you will, for other taxing authorities to come into the state. And just for purposes of discussion, we'll say for other states. But when they talk about these hundreds of other taxing authorities, it's a reference to the fact that throughout the country, there are municipal sales taxes, county sales taxes. So there are hundreds of potential jurisdictions to deal with. But the state will pass a law that makes it incredibly cumbersome to collect these taxes, whereby you'll have to notify the attorney general that you intend to do so, and he will make you jump through so many legal hoops that the hope is that a lot of the states or taxing authorities will simply say, small state like New Hampshire, it's not worth it. We'll see how that plays out. There are some lawmakers who, like State Senator Sharon Carson, who said yesterday, it disturbs me that we're talking about passing a law that would even enable this under any circumstances. Why can't we just pass a law that says you cannot collect sales taxes from New Hampshire merchants? And that was viewed as a little unrealistic by the professional members of the administration, the attorney general, the governor's attorney, and others who said that would be very dangerous because businesses would rely on that as some form of state protection, and if it was challenged and failed, they could be liable for not only back taxes but fees and penalties. So we can't act like this is something that New Hampshire has the sovereignty to simply refuse to participate in.
Mm-hmm. Lauren?
This whole story is fascinating to me. I feel like it just leaves so many open questions, one of which that Dave's talking about is how much room really is there for us under this Supreme Court ruling to really, you know, make a legislative change that's legal? And another question that I think about a lot is how many businesses are there in New Hampshire that do a significant amount of business online? Or, you know, the couple companies I could think of are, you know, small businesses, maybe like a thrift store or something that has an Instagram account that, you know, has people from across the country ordering from them online. But, you know, what kind of companies are there that are doing such business that this would be really onerous?
Well, actually, the New Hampshire, I think it's the New Hampshire Retail Association. I remember when the Wayfair decision came out, they actually didn't take a position on this bill because actually there is sort of not so much disagreement, but differing kind of views on how these companies will approach it. So apparently, some of the larger companies were fine with the decision, were kind of expecting the decision, and mm-hmm. then obviously the smaller companies in New Hampshire were not. And so the Retail Association, you know, big lobbying force, did not actually weigh in. And to that point, the draft legislation that the governor unveiled would allow companies, if they are okay with these taxes being collected, they can do it. They can allow that to go forward. If they determine that it's in their interests, they can do that. So it'll be interesting to see kind of how many companies decide that whatever surcharge you know, they'll have to pay to the state of Florida or California or to the city of San Francisco or whatever it might be is less painful than this whole legal rigmarole, which also involves them and will likely lead to lawsuits that involve them and the attorney general's office, but maybe way more headaches for them than they necessarily want. So there is a fail-safe in the law. If the law passes, how it actually comes out in practice is kind of what's up in the air now.
Well, Lauren, let me ask you, forgive me, Dave, but I wanted to ask Lauren, Is this coming up in the race for Congress in CD1? Because this seems like something Congress might have something to do
with.
Well,
so it's interesting you say that. So the person, I would say, so there's three Republicans. Well, there's maybe six, but there are three main Republicans, and then there are 11 Democrats. And basically what I've heard is, and we've talked about in this program before, that this is like the bipartisan issue of our time, which is hilarious. And we found one. And so, but I was at a debate the other day for Republican candidates on CD1 side, and Bruce Crochetier actually brought it up as one of his priorities if elected, you know, when asked by the moderator, you know, when you get down there, what's the first thing you would do? And he brought up this Wayfair decision. So I think anybody running for office is going to be talking about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, New Hampshire's congressional delegation, they are kind of submitting legislation. But I do want to go to that point. The governor's counsel, John Formella, kind of brought this up. So what happened with the Supreme Court in Wayfair is they did not come down with a definitive ruling that kind of settles this entirely. What they did is they decided that there needs to be. It's long been held in the Supreme Court that in order for another state to tax a business that isn't in that state, there has to be something called substantial nexus. And until last month, that nexus needed to require the company to be physically in the state.
Right.
Now that requirement is gone, but you still need substantial nexus. So how that is determined remains to be seen. And I just want to read a quote from John Formella from yesterday's briefing. He said, "The legislation is an attempt to lay the groundwork for developing the law," the governor's proposed legislation. He said, quote, "One of the things that we're going to see in the coming years is that if Congress doesn't act, the law will develop gradually through omission. Part of the point of this statute is to allow the Department of Justice to take a leading role in that." So basically, expect lawsuits, expect dozens of lawsuits, expect hundreds of lawsuits. Any town, any municipality, any county, any state can sue New Hampshire to try to get these sales taxes, or New Hampshire can sue to try to block them, and you're going to expect that. So this legislation that's being proposed is really just kind of like a framework for how this huge brewing legal fight is going to play out, and that's going to be fascinating. And there are a lot of outsiders looking in across the country who are observing what New Hampshire does because of all the sales tax-free states. We seem to have taken the most aggressive lead in pushing back on this decision.
Live for your die, Ethan.
Yeah, live for your die, exactly. Dave, you wanted to weigh in?
No, I was just going to say the best hope for some timely resolution of this is the legislation that Shaheen and Hassan are proposing. But that's a long stretch in Congress because 45 states in effect benefit from the court decision, and President Trump supports it because he thinks it hurts Amazon. So it's going to be hard to resolve this legislatively. If Congress is frozen on it like it is on everything else, it'll fall to the courts, as everything seems to fall these days, to be resolved over a series of lawsuits in the ensuing 5 to 10 years.
Lawsuits. All right. Coming up. Well, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. We're speaking with our guests today about the week's news. And coming up, we're going to be talking about the debate between the Republican candidates for New Hampshire's 1st Congressional District. Did you see the whole debate? If so, what do you think of the candidates? How did they do? Did one stand out to you? Give us a call. 1-800-892-6477. Or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Republican candidates running for their party's nomination in the race to replace retiring Representative Carol Shea Porter. They did meet for a debate this week. And Lauren, you reported on this. What issues did the candidates speak about?
So the big issues, I would say, on the Republican side this year are immigration. They talk a lot about the national debt. They talk about entitlement reform. They talk about guns, but they talk about, you know, protecting the Second Amendment on the Republican side. It's really interesting, though, to see how the three main candidates are trying to, like, chart out their path. They're not, I would say, the three of them aren't the most well-known people across the state. I mean, of course, Senator Andy Sanborn's been around for about 8 years in the state legislature, so that might be a familiar name to some people. He's from Bedford. But Bruce Crochetier, completely new to politics from Hampton Falls, is a businessman. He owns Focus Technology Solutions. It's an IT company. And Eddie Edwards, some people may know him. He's worked in the Liquor Commission and was the chief of police in Southampton. But so they're introducing themselves to voters. So I think a lot of what they're doing is, of course, talking about the issues. But each of them has been trying to define this path of why they're not a politician. And at first, this was kind of interesting to me to watch. I mean, you're running for office, so might, you know, say that that means that you are a politician. But then when I talked to voters afterward, it was in Derry, so in Rockingham County, this is actually like working. Voters are really interested to hear. And the ones I spoke to, Republicans in Rockingham County, are politicians aren't, they don't have a great reputation with these voters. And so they are looking for someone who can prove to them that they've spent more time out of government than in it.
Did any one candidate really stand out?
Stand out how?
I guess, did they say anything that was surprising or completely different from what the other two candidates on the stage were saying?
Well, yes and no. You know, with primaries, there's a lot of similarities. You know, they all want the wall, for example. I will say, I think the biggest split is social issues. Bruce Crocheteer is pro-choice, and he spoke with me afterwards a little bit about how this is a personal decision. He doesn't want to get into why, but he doesn't believe in publicly funded abortions, which we heard a lot about this week in the governor's race. But the other two consider themselves to be social conservatives. So I think with all the talk about the Supreme Court and Roe v. Wade, even though they're running for Congress, that's kind of a relevant split. So voters who may find themselves to be more moderate Republicans may be interested to hear that difference.
Okay. And we also heard this from Eddie Edwards. He used his closing statement in the debate to raise the issue of allegations against opponent Andy Sanborn.
Senator Sanborn has two allegations right now that he needs to answer. Why? Because we can't afford to lose this seat, and we can't afford to put somebody on the stage who cannot stand up and hold our values.
So that's Eddie Edwards during his closing remarks. Andy Sanborn didn't have a chance to reply from the stage, but responded after the debate to reporters.
I have never in my life, I have never been inappropriate, said something disrespectful. It's just not who I am as a person.
Lauren, that was your reporting.
So let me give you the setup here. So we were at this debate. It's about an hour long. And this was the day that news had broken of this second allegation. Basically, there were details and transcripts from when Andy Sanborn was investigated by the attorney general. These transcripts suggested that there may have been a second inappropriate comment made to a staffer. So this is the same day as the debate. So the hour is going on and I'm thinking, oh, is this going to come up? Is this going to come up? And the moderator didn't bring it up. And then, like you say, in his closing statement, Eddie Edwards, who was the third and final speaker, drops this bomb of like, you know, you need to answer to this, Andy Sanborn. Andy Sanborn's like, can I have a rebuttal? Over LaMontagne, the moderator, no, you cannot. And so it was really interesting because if not for Eddie Edwards, we wouldn't have heard about this during the debate whatsoever. Of course, reporters, we would have asked him about it later. And that's when Andy Sanborn kind of came frustrated off the stage and said that, you know, this is a witch hunt and this is from my political enemies and the political establishment, which is kind of what we've been hearing,
well,
Dave.
There was a candidate who's on the ballot that wasn't on that stage, perennial gadfly
and
political candidate, a dark horse. Andy Martin,
yes,
an attorney out of Manchester, who's just been sort of marginalized in this whole thing, as he has been in several other races mm-hmm. over the years. But he was smart enough to ask the attorney general through a right-to-know request for all of the files related to the investigation into Sanborn's comments commissioned this year. Requested this year by Senate President Chuck Morse, the second investigation, because these comments were initially investigated by at the order of by outside counsel at the order of then Senate President Peter Bragdon in 2013. So this was the second go round on this. And he requested the paperwork. Those of us in the media who were in Andy Martin's email chain noticed this and said, hey, he's going to get them. We want them too. And so we all got a hold of it, ran with it. And it revealed, A, this second incident. You had the first incident that was revealed about the intern who heard a remark and allegedly and got to, money and a job to keep silent, which the AG said is not what happened based on their investigation.
But did confirm that he made an inappropriate comment.
But
in
did
that
confirm
one.
That the comment was made and money exchanged hands. But it was all described as all fairly innocent by the parties directly involved. And if that's what they say, that's what they have to go by. But then the second, these transcripts revealed a second incident involving a female staffer who, upon leaving the room, Andy said to another male intern an inappropriate comment to the effect of, you know, I bet you would like to blank.
her. And then also it was revealed that at one point he was denied any staff assignments to his office until he took a sexual harassment training course, something that hadn't been previously revealed. And I think this is going to dog Andy throughout the campaign.
I agree.
Because there's going to be other tranches of material released. And Andy runs a bar, the draft. And when you stand behind the bar and you're dealing with people and you have acquire a certain attitude, he apparently in the earlier years of his tenure, he didn't really shut that off to the extent you're supposed to when you get to the State House. And there are other examples of that. He had a sign posted at outside his office calling it a man cave, you know, swimming pool and beer served inside. He had big screen pool tables. He tweeted something about Hagee Masson, which he was roundly criticized for when he was considering challenging incumbent Governor Maggie Hassan. He was quoted in a Hippo article saying he preferred the days when women came to the bars dressed up and with makeup and thought that was a good thing. So none of these are huge transgressions, but it just portrays sort of an attitude that does not bode well in the Me Too era.
I'll refer you back to the comment you heard from him, which is that I've never made an inappropriate comment in my life. And so, and I can also say that from talking to Eddie Edwards afterwards, this is not the end of Eddie Edwards bringing this up. And I asked him, you know, why bring it up at the end? And he said, I was just trying to follow the rules. You know, we're not supposed to stray from the other questions. But all that to say, I think you're right, Dave, that this is not going anywhere.
And I think that kind of you're speaking to sort of the idea of an outsider candidate. You see this in virtually every election in
right.
the country, it seems like. But his defense when this news broke earlier this week was he called this Washington-style swamp politics that people are sick and tired of, specifically the new allegations that are coming out. And he says because he's a conservative Republican disruptor, he's used to getting targeted by the establishment. It's just worth bearing that these transcripts, one of them was from a former Republican Senate chief of staff, two sitting Republican senators, one of whom is the president, one of whom is the majority leader. It was turned into an investigation by the present GOP leadership's chief of staff, who apparently was acting, according to the transcripts, on, you know, hearing new things from the Senate clerk. The Republican-appointed attorney general then opened up this grand jury investigation, and the resulting transcripts have now been released. So, you know, it is certainly like a one-party type of thing at the moment, the party in power. So to the extent to which he can turn that into some narrative about the establishment Republicans being against him, he may try to do that, and I'm sure we'll see more of that. But the real question is how persuasive the allegations are in the minds of voters, and that may ultimately overpower his argument.
And some people don't care about it, right? There are voters who care. There are voters who don't.
We've seen that.
Right, exactly.
On a national scale.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, we should take a short break, but when we come back, let's talk a little bit about news this week regarding St. Paul's School. Lauren, you spoke a little bit about that this week. We'll also talk about the race for governor. We'll talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who made a visit to New Hampshire this week. If you have questions or comments about the week's news, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
I was so surprised when I won those gas gift cards. Don Serrato of Concord was one of NHPR's early bird winners last year. So I bought 6 tickets for $150. It was a great investment when you look at the ROI on that. I didn't expect to win. You don't do it because you expect to win. You do it because you support NHPR. But I was thrilled. It was just, I don't win anything. That's not my thing.
Winning could be your thing, but don't wait. Get your raffle tickets today at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello, here in the studio with Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, Lauren Chulgin of NHPR, Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, and joining us for this part of the program, NHPR's Dan Tuohy. Hey, Dan.
Good morning.
So let's talk first in this part of the program about St. Paul's School, because, Lauren, you reported this week that St. Paul's has sort of upped its game in providing some resources for sexual abuse victims, this time specifically for people who have participated in its summer program.
Yes. Well, credit to Dave's newsroom for breaking this news. So here's basically what happened. A lot of people are familiar with the Advanced Studies program. That's the summer program, much beloved that St. Paul's puts on every summer for New Hampshire public school kids. And it's, you know, very prestigious. You apply. It's very exclusive. And kids, I shouldn't say kids, students love it. And so they've kind of escaped a lot of this drama and ongoing saga of the decades and decades of allegations of sex abuse between faculty and students at the full-time boarding school at St. Paul's. And it hadn't really affected attendance. It hadn't really affected interest. And then I got word from attorney Peter Hutchins that he had someone come forward to him that in 1967, he was a student. This client was a student of the summer program, and he had been assaulted by a longtime teacher there. And so he had approached Peter about it. This is not someone who was in the Kastner and Edwards report, but that which was the independent report that the school had asked be done. And he had heard about that, and that has kind of empowered him to come forward. So this was the first lawsuit or claim that we had heard regarding to the summer program. So that was filed on Monday. But before that official filing, St. Paul's on Friday emailed a letter to any former ASP student that they had an email for, saying that the resources that we recently announced for our alumni are also available to you and anybody that wants to come forward. You can have access to a general therapy assistance fund, which we can go into more about what that is. There's also a new way out of the court system that they're working on settling a lot of these abuse cases. And then they also have access to, they're trying to do a new alumni program to kind of rebuild the culture, so to speak. So this was interesting for a number of reasons. One, as I say, ASP has kind of stayed out of the light of all of this. The other is because attorney Peter Hutchins and others have said to me, this has been a long time coming. The resources that were provided to these students that we only heard about last week should have come years and years ago, especially the therapy assistance fund, which is something I've reported on a lot. And Peter Hutchins says that this should have also been available to summer school kids because you don't always know. Now, people don't always come forward with these allegations. So, you know, the saga continues.
So tell us about the therapy program.
Sure. So this is kind of a newish trend that started out of the settlements that happened with the Archdiocese in Boston. A big part of the settlement many years ago now, was that there's a general therapy assistance fund. And basically that means if you've been abused, whether you file a lawsuit or you don't, you have access to a pool of resources that allows you to have your therapy paid for. So other private schools were doing this. Choate was doing this. St. George's was doing this. And St. Paul's had not. And so there was some criticism about how this had not transpired. And so I did a story about how other schools had done it and they didn't. And then they came out and said, you know what, we are going to do it. We've been planning on it. Here we go. So that's one of the things that now alumni of St. Paul's, the full-time school and the summer program will have access to. And the other, like I say, is they have an independent monitor that alumni can go to if they want to, you know, sue or if they file a claim against the school.
All right. Well, NHPR's Lauren Julian, thanks very much for all your reporting on this. We really appreciate it.
Thanks.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. If you've got a question or comment about the week's news, we've still got some folks here in the studio happy to answer them. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. In the race for governor, there's been a development this week in the sense that there's been a lot of response to the Supreme Court sort of drifting towards the right and fears that Roe v. Wade will be overturned. Abortion rights won't be as they have been since Roe v. Wade. And Steve Marchand and Molly Kelly have come out with their own ways of defending a woman's right to choose. Maybe I could start by asking you, Ethan, what exactly these candidates have been saying and how what they've been saying has differed.
Sure. Well, as NHPR has reported, the candidates have differed in their specificity on what they would want. I mean, they both have been emphatic in their support for Roe versus Wade. But Steve Marchand has kind of gone forward with a specific policy proposal that has certainly, you know, farther than I think any candidate has in a while, which is public funding of abortions. He's advocating the use of Medicaid dollars to you know publicly fund abortions. There's something called the Hyde Amendment that certain states have waived and kind of passed their own laws, and he points to 17 states that have done this. So he has a very kind of specific in some ways, politically provocative proposal. And his opponent, Molly Kelly, is playing it safer. She's not directly proposing anything policy-related that she would have New Hampshire do if, you know, developments in the Supreme Court were to change the nature of abortion-related law.
Mm-hmm. I think this primary is fascinating because it's a replay of what we often see in these the Democratic primary in particular, which is one candidate taking the more moderate position, one candidate really playing to the radical base of the party. We saw this in 2012 when then State Senator Jackie Sillie ran against then Senator Maggie Hassan, with Hassan taking the pledge and Sillie refusing not to, and Jackie Sillie generally positioning herself as the progressive champion, Hassan more down the middle. And we're seeing that in this race, with Marchand basically going hard left all the way, wanting to make New Hampshire a sanctuary state, taxpayer funding for abortion. And he's basically made the calculus that rolling down the middle doesn't work anymore. Nationally or locally. And we will see how that calculus plays out when the primary votes are cast.
It's also the dog days of summer, right, where these candidates, whether it's running for governor or Congress, they'll do anything to get noticed, to get attention. And it's very difficult out there. We saw, like, Declan McLaughlin this week, one of the candidates for the Democratic nomination for Congress in the 1st District, come out with a proposal to lower the voting age to 16. That seemed to that caught my attention. These candidates will do anything to get some notice by the press and by
also,
voters.
I mean, speaking to Dave's point, I think it's certainly kind of the parallels that you saw with the Bernie and Hillary kind of face off. But beyond just an ideological kind of difference, there's also a difference in sort of how they style themselves to voters. I think Marchand has prided himself. He prided himself in 2016. He's priding himself this time around in being kind of a data wonk, a policy wonk. Kind of he will go into a 5-minute lecture on property taxes and you know that's his means of kind of presenting his platform. Molly tends to kind of go broader and go into fewer specifics when she talks about things, which kind of is playing out here with the with this abortion these abortion policies, and that's just sort of a trademark part of Marchand's strategy, which you know endears himself to some and perhaps not so much to others.
I guess we'll find out how many,
right,
in the September 11th primary. We should talk about Attorney General Jeff Sessions, because Jeff Sessions was here in New Hampshire this week talking about enforcing drug laws, particularly when it comes to those who deal with fentanyl. And so tell us, Ethan, what exactly was he here to say?
So he was here to make an announcement. They're basically trying to beef up the kind of law enforcement side of treatment. He said at one point that the E in DEA stands for enforcement. There's been some, you know, controversy about that, over whether that's the right focus to fight back against this epidemic. But to that end, he has identified 10 districts around the country. Districts are, you know, they're kind of subsidiaries of the U.S. Department of Justice, and New Hampshire has one in Concord.
There's Maine as well, covering Maine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. And so he, 10 of the ones that are hardest hit by the opioid crisis, including Maine, including New Hampshire, including Ohio, Tennessee, Pennsylvania, et cetera, will get an additional prosecutor. This follows two prosecutors that were added to New Hampshire's office, to all office, districts earlier this year. So he's beefing up. And the idea of the new prosecutor is to focus on fentanyl and focus on fentanyl prosecutions. And as he puts it, kind of, he said no amount of fentanyl is too small to prosecute. And that's the idea. He's pointing to a county in Florida, Manatee County, where they started kind of prosecuting every single amount of fentanyl that they could make a case on. And he says that their numbers, kind of their overdose numbers, fell after they did that. So he's modeling that approach. How much that affects, I mean, fentanyl is so widespread. And if you look at the overdose death stats, it's really overtaken. It's overtaken heroin. You can't even call this a heroin crisis anymore. There was the number of heroin deaths a year is in the single digits. So fentanyl is widespread in New Hampshire. So how much one extra prosecutor will help, and a shift in focus will help against the massive tide. Will remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. But that was his message he was bringing to me.
Yeah, and protesters also brought a message. They certainly were not happy with what you were saying, the enforcement approach, but they also were concerned, as far as I know, about the ACA, right?
Yeah. I didn't speak to them, but
not entirely clear about what the protesters were saying on that point.
I didn't speak to them on that point, but they were certainly kind of on the point of opioids, talking a lot about, you know, there were signs that said healthcare, not prisons, and their point there was that there should be more resources devoted to prevention and treatment efforts. And
yeah, there were a couple different signs on the sidewalk that we saw. I think Robert Grover for NHPR was there covering it. And I think there were multiple different issues brought up at that protest. But going back to the enforcement issue, the enforcement and prosecution is one leg of the stool here. I mean, prevention, treatment, recovery, it's all very important. But, you know, we've seen this over and over for the past 2 years. Members, including our elected leaders, saying we can't arrest our way out of this problem. Mm-hmm. And here we are in this announcement this week, which is all very important and to the point, but it's heavy on prosecution. And it's not just these small-time drug dealers, but international prospective drug traffickers as well.
We got a mixed message from Sessions on this, because at one point he said this is to go up the chain, which I think even those who are argue very aggressively on the treatment versus prosecution side would agree, the more we can really go up the chain and get the big syndicate-level distributors and the organized crime, the major importers that are bringing the bulk volume into the country and then into the state, that's definitely a focus for law enforcement that there's broad consensus on. But this notion of arresting every street-level user as having the kind of positive effects that the Attorney General alluded to is significantly in debate and could just result in excessive overcrowding in prisons and all kinds of outcomes that are not contributing positively to resolving. I guess we'll just have to see.
And he also, another just ancillary announcement that he made was he's creating a data and analytics team that's going to look at prescriptions. And if you look at the numbers in New Hampshire and in other states, prescriptions have dropped in recent years. It seems like that is sort of through a whole bunch of fronts, including public awareness. That's sort of stopped becoming as strong of a contributor to this crisis as it has in the past. But Sessions wants to increase that, kind of along the same vein as our prescription drug monitoring program that we recently implemented.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've got more to talk about this week on the substance abuse front, but let's take a quick break. Listeners, if you have questions or comments about the week's news, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. We've got Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor here, as well as Dave Solomon of the Union Leader and NHPR's Dan Tuohy. Answering your questions, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello here in the studio with Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, NHPR's Dan Tuohy, and Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor. We are talking about the week's news, and it has been a busy week. Listeners, give us a call if you have questions or comments about the week's news. 1-800-892-6477. We were talking earlier in the program about the New Hampshire Supreme Court's ruling, or rather advisory opinion, that eliminating the distinction between domicile and residency for voting purposes is constitutional. And we got a couple of emails from listeners. I want to share them with you. Kyle emailed in favor of HB 1264, which is the bill that would do that. Kyle wrote to say, I think you should have to be a resident. If you're a student and don't plan on living in New Hampshire, you don't have a right, in my opinion, to vote in New Hampshire. So that's from Kyle. And then Jillian in Pembroke wrote, as a native New Hampshire resident millennial who also went to college here, I sincerely hope that the governor vetoes this bill. New Hampshire is among the demographically oldest states in the country, and a bill like this isn't going to bring young people in. College students spend money in our communities, they do community service in our communities, and they add diversity to our state. Why on earth would we want to alienate the very same people we would like to ultimately settle and stay here? That's the comment from Jillian in Pembroke. Thank you very much to Kyle and Jillian for writing in. You can write in with your opinions on the week's news, exchange at nhpr.org. exchangeexchange.org. Before we go any further, too, I do want to let you know about one more thing we're doing this summer on the Exchange on Thursdays. Every Thursday, we're doing a series called Going Local, where we devote an hour to each region of the state and discuss the culture and issues of the region. Next Thursday, we're going to look at the Seacoast. You can find more information and submit your questions, stories, and recommendations for your region or any region at nhpr.org/exchange. All right, so let's talk a little bit about something that I think both of your organizations have been reporting on, Dave and Ethan. That's that has to do with licensing for sober living houses. The state is considering some licensing requirements for sober living houses, some of them, not all of them, and there's been some pushback on that. But first, Ethan, can you explain to us why the state thinks that some of these licensing requirements are necessary?
Sure. So there's been focus both in New Hampshire and nationally on sober homes. They've obviously been rising in coordination with the crisis, but there have been some kind of bogus situations where the homes are not they're not providing the services, or they're not even sober homes. So there've been a few bad actors, that's created a situation where the state has felt the need to license the facilities to better kind of assure that everything is above board. And this is sort of in theory welcomed by the homes, but the way that the state is going about it in this case is something that they're kind of pushing back against. They say that it's by adding these licensing requirements, essentially what they've done is kind of pushed the sober homes even further out of the spotlight, and they're saying that there'll be kind of just sort of weakening overall of oversight, and it'll sort of backfire in the end.
Mm-hmm. This is in the context of the recovery process, in which it often starts with a safe station visit, and you're hospitalized and you're detoxed, and then you end up going to a residential care facility like Keystone Hall or Farnham House or someplace where there's clinical staff present. And these are all very heavily supervised and licensed facilities that have to meet hundreds of pages of requirements. But eventually, your recovery reaches the point where you're not quite ready to go back into everyday life, but you can achieve a certain sense of normalcy by going into a dorm-like atmosphere with a group house with a lot of other people who are in recovery, trying to keep each other sober, trying to keep drugs and alcohol out of the place. And these take many forms. They can be just a simple democracy where an agency has obtained a property and basically serves as landlord, but it's occupied by six or seven or eight people in recovery. It's a democracy. They pay their rent. They vote on who's going to go get the groceries. And you can't license that, and the state doesn't. That's like a tier one, I guess. Mm-hmm. Then there's another level where there's maybe a manager or a house RA, resident assistant kind of person, supervisor who gets free rent. That's not going to be managed. That's just people living together under shared arrangements. But if one of these buildings is affiliated with an agency that offers these people services on an outpatient basis, or is in an array of services by an agency that offers some of the higher level services as well, then they would fall under the licensing requirement. And though those groups that operate in that sphere say, we understand that this level of our service and that level has to be licensed, but if they start trying to license the group homes we just try to put these people in, they're going to change them into institutions too, and we're going to detach them from our services so that we don't have to be licensed, and these people will have less access to services because of this.
Right. They'll move down a level so they won't have as much care, won't provide as much care, and it'll be back to the informal arrangement, which is sometimes just the house. With people who have an agreement. This also comes on the backdrop of this is the sober homes have struggled in various communities around the state to kind of navigate zoning laws. There's a lot of NIMBYism when it comes to a sober house. And one of the concerns that I heard that I thought was interesting in response to this idea of licensing is often when you come before a zoning board in a town, you're sort of as a sober home in this sort of gray area in terms of where you can set up. Advocates, treatment advocates and sober home advocates say the whole point of sober home living is to kind of establish a community and establish a safe space that feels like a home. And so it's important to kind of for them, they say, to have these homes kind of in residential areas, it's just basically a big house. If the licensing goes forward, they've warned, that will give zoning boards kind of a clear signal. They're licensed with the state now, this home, that this is a treatment center and not a residential home. And if that happens, then they may be zoned into areas where there are only treatment centers, and that may cause further stigma. It'll, you know, potentially pull them away from, you know, the main parts of town, and it will kind of discourage the whole ethos of the movement. That was one criticism that I heard. Whereas now, without this, you know, there's a little bit more gray area, although always an uphill battle, they say, with residents who are very skeptical of sober homes and, you know, perhaps a little prejudicial.
We're seeing this in Rochester right now, community rallying against this very type of establishment in their neighborhood.
Well, let me ask you, are these licensing requirements a done deal, or are they still up for debate?
They're up for a public comment period, and my understanding is that they're not connected to any particular bill, but this is something that the department is sort of moving ahead with. The public comment period that we both attended this week was, you know, obviously filled with some of these, you know, organizers, and it remains to be seen what the department does with the feedback it got. Almost all of it was negative against this, but the department says that, you know, this is simply kind of bringing some of these higher service sober homes in line with residential treatment centers, and that they say that it won't be any more burden than there is now.
Well, these will, I believe, have to be approved ultimately by the Joint Legislative Committee on Administrative Rules, this Senate and representative panel that has to sign off on all the rules these agencies promulgate before they take effect. And that is often the venue where the opposition comes into play again. So the opponents of this will certainly have another bite of the apple.
Okay. A few more things to discuss before the end of the show today, and that is a couple of bills that Governor Sununu signed dealing with chemical contamination and health risks. One of these could lead to stricter limits on PFAS chemicals in drinking water. Dave, can you tell us about this one?
The governor signed the bill that would increase the limits on – that would make the state limits on these contaminants I think it was put it under study, not to sign right. lower limits, but to at least put the matter to study, which is something of great interest, of course, in the seacoast and in areas like Bedford and Litchfield, where there's been serious contamination by the businesses that produce these plastic components that up to this point the state has considered what some environmentalists view as a very high level of contamination is acceptable. And there's been legislation that was promoted throughout the year to get to direct the Department of Environmental Safety to impose a more rigid standard to say very minuscule amounts of this stuff is dangerous. And that didn't pass, but at least a bill requiring them to study whether the acceptable level should be lowered was signed into law.
Mm-hmm. And the second bill that he signed was that one that would let firefighters qualify faster for workers' compensation after a cancer diagnosis, essentially making it assume that their cancer is work-related, right?
Yeah, this has been the biggest policy initiative of one of the most powerful unions in the state throughout the past legislative session, the New Hampshire Professional Firefighters Association. They feel there's a large body of medical and scientific evidence that's been accumulated in recent years that shows that firefighters are at an extremely high rate of cancer due to their exposure to the foams and chemicals and used in fighting fires, not to mention smoke and other contaminants they inhale in their professional career. And there's been a reluctance to allow lung cancer to be considered as a disability qualifying for workers' compensation or other benefits because there are so many other ways you can get lung cancer. How can you prove it was associated with your work? But this bill creates certain standards relative to documenting your smoking history and so forth, creates measures by which firefighters will be required to demonstrate that there is sufficient evidence that they don't have other circumstances that could be proven to have contributed to the cancer and therefore will be able to qualify for benefits under this bill.
And finally, let's talk about the bear.
The bear.
We should talk about the bear. The most famous bear in New Hampshire, mink. Andrew Timmons, who leads bear policy at New Hampshire Fish and Game, is a little distressed about mink Dantooine. That's the female bear that was relocated away from the Hanover area to the North Country at Governor Sununu's insistence over the objection of people like Timmons, who claimed she should be euthanized. She was getting into human sources of food, really posing possible threat to human beings in that area. And Timmons is distressed because mink is traveling a lot.
Yes, the bear was relocated to northern New Hampshire, northern Coos County, and it's apparently traveled more than 80 miles towards Lyme, New Hampshire, or Hanover, New Hampshire, to meet up with its cubs. And it's Andy Timmons is the bear biologist, of course, with New Hampshire Fish and Game. Just saying it's very sad to watch because they have a tracking collar on this bear.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a story that just never seems to get out of the news, right?
Yeah.
And the governor was asked about it this week, and he says, no regrets, quote unquote.
He has a little bear on the receptionist desk in his office with a little bib on it that says, thank you, governor, for saving the bears that came to him from a group of students who follow the news. Whether this turns out to be a smart decision or not remains to be seen. You know, if some ill befalls these bears, there's going to be a lot of second guessing about whether the governor was correct in overriding the scientific judgment of the wildlife management professionals in the state to achieve what appeared to be a feel-good outcome.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen, for being on the show today. I want to thank Ethan DeWitt of the Concord Monitor, Dave Solomon of the Union Leader, and NHPR's Dan Tuohy. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thanks also to NHPR's Lauren Chooljian, who joined us earlier in the program. You can find links to all the stories we discussed today at nhpr.org. And remember, the conversation continues online at nhpr.org and on Facebook. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and our intern is Abby Sleeper. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.